Welcome to the Pulteney Street Podcast. I'm your host, President Joyce Jacobson. The Geneva Music Festival's 2021 season begins this month. For 10 years, the festival has presented acclaimed international artists in venues throughout the Finger Lakes region. My guest today is the festival's artistic director and founder, Jeffrey Hurd. Jeff, who grew up in Geneva, is an accomplished violinist, teacher, and artistic director. Jeff studied at Rice University, Yale School of Music, and the Cleveland Institute of Music, and has performed throughout the United States, Latin America, and Asia, including in Carnegie Hall's Weill Recital Hall. In 2016, he joined the faculty at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, where he has built a thriving studio, attracting students from around the globe who frequently participate in some of the nation's top music festivals. And he was also recently appointed to the University of Louisville faculty as an assistant professor of violin. In addition to his teaching and his role in running the Geneva Music Festival, Jeff is co-director of the Knoxville Suzuki Academy, director of the University of Tennessee String Project, and president-elect of the Tennessee chapter of the American String Teacher Association. Jeff Hurd, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Joyce. Great to be here.
Well, can you, as somebody new to the region, could you tell me some things about the history of the Geneva Music Festival? How and why did you start it? And what made 2011 the right time and Geneva the right place?
Sure. Yeah, so 2011 was a long time ago now. I was actually a student at Yale University at the time. And I had the idea to start the music festival because in the years prior, maybe starting around 2009, there was a group of local music lovers that were bringing some of us who had grown up in Geneva and went on to careers in music back to Geneva to perform. And I, you know, this was one of my first paid chamber music opportunities at the time. Our concerts were very well attended and we were selling tickets. And so as a student after my first year at Yale, I was looking for ways to expand my chamber music career. And I also thought that this might be a wonderful way to give back to the city of Geneva that had always supported me and had always been my most ardent fans ever since the time I was a little boy. Also around the same time, Geneva was featured on some home improvement show. I forget what it was, but they were talking about Geneva and the way they described the city was very negative. And while Geneva, like any city, has its issues, my experience growing up there was that there were many people dedicated to bettering the community, dedicated to equal access to opportunity for everybody in the community. And I thought that a music festival highlighting musicians from Geneva, and then now our extended professional network, could become a major cultural ambassador for the city of Geneva. So that was our mission from day one, to bring great music to the residents of Geneva and the Finger Lakes, and to highlight to the area all the great things that were going on in Geneva.
That is great. Wonderful that you had that much initiative while in graduate school.
Well, and I couldn't have imagined, I knew that we would have some support for the idea. I couldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams the amount of community support and passion and effort that went into helping this festival grow over the last 10 years. Really, truly special. And I think you'd find very few music festivals that in such a short period of time grew from a one weekend of concerts, which was what we did in 2011, to what we're doing this year, which is a month-long music festival featuring some of the greatest artists of our time.
Right. It is amazing. So here we are in May 2021, not that long past that. So what are some of the festivals, or what have been some of the festival's major highlights in this past decade?
Sure. Well, there's a lot, but I'll try to pick a few. Maybe one of the most special highlights was the first time that Ani Kavafian came to join us, which I believe was in 2013. At the time, I would have just graduated from Yale, and she was my teacher there. And she had also coached Hannah Collins, who is another Geneva musician who's gone on to a prominent career. And so we knew Ani, and she's a very famous and esteemed artist. I mean, one of the most acclaimed chamber musicians, I would say, of the last 30 years. And so it was a big change in what the Geneva Music Festival was doing, from, you know, presenting us young, talented students to having this very esteemed guest artist. And I think it got everybody's wheels turning about, like, wow, we can bring in the very best to Geneva. And so she led us in a performance of Mendelssohn's Octet. We meant to play that piece once again this year when she returned as part of our 10-year celebration. Because of COVID restrictions and the need to maintain social distancing, we chose not to have an octet just so we didn't have to have eight people on stage at the same time. But it's a nice coming full circle this year, having Ani back to visit with us once again. Some other highlights, let me think. I think it was 2016 was our Hispanic cultural celebration in which we highlighted music that came from Latinx backgrounds. And one of the ways we did that was with the bandoneon player J.P. Joffrey. And you don't often get to hear concert tango music performed live. And as classical musicians, we often don't get to play that kind of music. So for us, the musicians, to get to perform alongside this tango, true tango master, right? Very few people in the world can do what he can do with the bandoneon. So for us to get this true immersion into that musical style as musicians, and for the audience to hear that music, was definitely a highlight. And that celebration of Latino culture shifted the music festival's vision of what a classical music organization can do and what it can be in a significant way. And that emphasis on diversity and representing the multicultural nature of our community has since that time become a centerpiece of our mission. And we were kind of a kickstarter to an idea that has now been picked up nationally. So you see many arts organizations picking up that idea. And our concert with JP and that whole celebration of Latino culture kind of kicked that off for us.
Well, that is great. And I think it is interesting to think about gender or genre bending these days. Everything's bending more. And so, I mean, for classical music, it seems very important to break out of genre to some degree, too. And I'm glad to hear you were on the forefront on that. Now, the festival's 10th season begins May 20th, 2021. Can you give us a little bit of a preview of that? And do you have any special celebrations planned during this year's festival? Are there any artists or performances that you're especially looking forward to? Though I know you want, of course, you like them all since you scheduled them all.
I do like them all. I was worried you might ask me that because they're all going to be quite special, I think. Our theme this year, rather than picking one genre or community of people to highlight, is to celebrate our first decade and all of the things that we have done in that first year, in that first 10 years. As such, we highlight music of many different influences, whether that's female composers or composers from Black or Latinx backgrounds, or just one of our major ideas is to bring back as many of our returning artists as possible in this one big nostalgic remembrance of everything we've done over the last 10 years. So I think every concert will be a highlight. I think the fact that many of us musicians have only maybe given one or two performances over the last 14 months or so is going to add an intensity and excitement to what we're doing. And I know our audiences haven't had the opportunity to see any live music in the last 14 years. So I think there'll be a synergy between the audience and the performer that will be very exciting. I can list a few artists, but it's all on our website, but yeah, I can highlight a couple of our returning artists' achievements this year. So for instance, we have Deshaun Burton and Michelle Kahn giving a recital at Geneva's beautiful Smith Opera House. And both of those wonderful musicians had very productive years, we can say. Deshaun was awarded a Grammy just a few months ago, and Michelle was appointed to the Curtis Institute of Music faculty, which is perhaps the most prestigious school of music in the world. So we're so lucky to have them here in Geneva. But every one of our concerts features, in all honesty, truly incredible people and musicians, and I'm so excited for them to be returning to Geneva once again.
No, I'm so glad we're able to provide some live experiences because it does, as you said, it's been such a tough year for performers. And there's such a depth of talent in chamber music in this area in general that it's just great we're able to do this. Now, last year's festival was unfortunately disrupted by COVID, but you were still able to connect with your audience. Tell people who maybe don't know exactly what you did last year, how you did adapt during 2020 relative, and also in way, how has the format of this year's festival changed somewhat to still deal with the ongoing effects of the pandemic?
Sure. So last year in March, I was actually in Geneva. We had one rehearsal at Frohlich Hall, Hobart William Smith College's campus, getting ready for our spring benefit. We met, it must have been Friday night, we met up to rehearse. And it was that week that, you know, news of COVID had really spread throughout the country and that all the arts organizations and universities were not going back to in-person events and classes after spring break. So we canceled the concert. And then in the weeks after, we had to decide very quickly what we were going to do in the summertime. I really pushed for us to keep providing music and educational opportunities despite the changes that were going to take place for a number of reasons. One, I think during this stressful time when people are alone and wondering what's going to happen, I think that music can provide solace and a way to, you know, help us feel community. And also as a musician, I wanted to make sure that many of my friends, you know, solely rely on performances for their income. And many musicians overnight saw all of their income evaporate. Many musicians are just starting to see, you know, the first work trickle back in. So I wanted to provide opportunities for them to keep practicing their craft. So we elected to shift to a virtual season. We had some live stream concerts, some pre-recorded concerts. We actually were able to bring in some Pulitzer Prize winning composers. We brought in Shulamit Ron, for instance, who was maybe first or second, I think she's the first female to ever win the Pulitzer Prize in music. So she got on a Zoom call with our audiences and discussed her music, which was very interesting because we had played her music at the festival in the past, but this gave the audiences a chance to sit down with her and ask her specific questions about her inspirations. We did the same with Jennifer Higdon as well. So we found different ways to connect our audiences with music. And then in the fall, we actually brought in string quartet Atlas, who will be returning to Geneva Music Festival. And working with Laurie Williams at North Street School, they created a joint performance with the students in the fourth and fifth grade. So the students who had homemade rhythm instruments that Laurie had already created for them as she was trying to find ways to suddenly teach music online, Atlas created accompaniment parts that these students could play with these homemade instruments. And so they, over 6 days, they visited with all the fourth and fifth graders at North Street School, and they put together a video performance. And then we hired a pianist that used to be at the, who played at the music festival in previous years, Christopher McKigan, who now lives in Thailand. And he is an amazing videographer and audio engineer. And he took all this footage we had of cell phone videos, of Zoom recordings, and put it together into a very nice final project that the students could watch and send home to their parents. So that was a really special way that we were able to keep supporting the schools, keep music education exciting and alive during this time. So it wasn't how we normally do things, but I will say I realized from very early on that this crisis was going to force classical musicians to innovate very quickly. As an industry, are sometimes a little bit behind the times in our use of technology and programming ideas. And so this gave us the impetus we needed to quickly learn, how do I live stream concerts? How can I, as a violinist, you know, learn some basic recording skills so that I can keep presenting music to audiences? And I think in the long run, this is going to help us going forward. I think many of the adaptations we made this year will become permanent fixtures in festivals and orchestras and schools going forward.
Well, I'm a big silver lining in the cloud person myself, so I'm glad to hear you were able to find some also. And certainly the improved ability of everybody to deal with technology, including a lot of audio and video technology, is something I think that relates strongly here. And it's been so interesting to hear about how you've thought a lot about culturally diverse programming and also outreach through local school districts. I mean, it's very traditional to have educational concerts, but to really do it in that mindful fashion is really awesome. And it makes clear that festivals are not just about the prime performances, but about all the additional activity that happens often when you bring people to the area. Maybe you could talk about some of your other work as well, such as with the String Project, which I believe also is a way to bring music and music education to the public, and especially to young people.
Yes. A couple of years ago, I was appointed as the director of our fledgling String Project of the University of Tennessee. And the National String Project Consortium is a program that partners with universities and helps them connect with city school districts. And basically, it provides music lessons that are primarily taught by undergraduate and graduate students at universities in public schools. So they're able to provide lessons at an extremely low cost or no cost at all. So what we ended up doing in Knoxville this year, because the beginning of our string project, our actual launch date coincided with the beginning of COVID, unfortunately. So we pivoted from what would have been large group lessons with some one-on-one interactions for the students. We ended up offering free lessons, free one-on-one Zoom lessons to some students at the Sarah Moore Green Magnet High School in Knoxville, which is a school with a 100% poverty rate. And the music teacher stayed a few hours after school twice a week so that these students could have 30-minute lessons each week. The University of Tennessee provided all the instruments, all the instruction. I had my graduate teaching assistants in charge of teaching the violinists, and we had a graduate teaching assistant cellist in charge of teaching the cellist, and I sort of oversaw that teaching. String projects are an incredible way for universities who are interested in reaching students that don't necessarily have the chance to study music in their regular day-to-day life and providing them that opportunity. I know the Sphinx organization, which is maybe the largest proponent of diversity in classical music, is a big supporter of the National String Project Consortium. So I'm actually leaving the University of Tennessee after this semester, but I know that the administration is eager to see their string project continue to grow and flourish in the coming years. And we're excited to have a sizable grant coming to the University of Tennessee from the National String Project Consortium that should fund that program for at least the next 4 years.
Well, hopefully when you move to Kentucky, you will be involved in similar types of initiatives there as well. So hopefully that will also be a fertile ground for this type of work. Now, I'm interested in your own musical background as well. I mean, we talked about where you went to do your work, but when did you begin learning music and how did you land on the violin as your instrument of choice?
So I actually started studying the violin when I was 4 years old. I was lucky that in Geneva, there was a robust Suzuki program that was brought by the Ithaca Talent Education School in Ithaca. They had a satellite program in Geneva and that had many, many participants. So many of my friends growing up also studied music, and my sister that's 2 years older than me, Caroline, she played the cello, and my sister who is 5 years older than me, Elizabeth, she played the violin. And so actually when I was still in the crib, I was humming my eldest sister's violin tunes. So I know there, for those who are familiar with the Suzuki books, I think I used to always hum Andantino because that's what my sister was working on. So from a young age, I was musically inclined, and we were lucky to have fantastic teachers in Geneva. So by the time I was 16, my parents thought that I should consider going away to music school in Cleveland, where my teacher at Ithaca Talent Education, Kirsten Marshall, had studied. So I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music as a junior in high school to start my conservatory education early. And the rest is history. I was just on that path and I've stayed there ever since.
Well, once you find what you like, though, as a cellist myself, I'm sorry to hear that the other sister wasn't more influential and you were humming cello, but that's okay. Well, which artists and composers have been some of the most influential in your musical development? I'm asking that as opposed to just like which ones you like the best.
Yes. Well, and I might deflect. I might answer with musicians because composers are a little bit difficult to say, but I would say maybe two of the most influential people on my music career would be first David Updegraff, who was the teacher that I went to study with at the Cleveland Institute of Music. He was my teacher for 6 years and, you know, from the time I was 16 to 22 of thereabouts. And he in some ways was like my musical father, and he emphasized that every note you play should be full of expression, that there's no benefit to trying to play robotically, trying to reach perfection, but that your goal is always to be expressive. And he was always teaching rubato, which is a method by which you bend the rhythm. So either you take a little bit of time at the beginning of a phrase so that you can speed up through the end of the phrase, or the opposite. And so his musicality gave the music a constant kind of ebb and flow and a kind of organic breathing quality. And that's kind of something I've been in search of the rest of my musical career. I can't say I've perfected it, but it's always in the back of my mind. And especially today with how common recordings are and how easy it is to just listen to recordings versus hearing a live performance. Sometimes music performances can seem a little bit rigid or mechanical because when you are recording something, you need it to be perfect. And that can take away some of that kind of natural kind of living, breathing quality. I would say another great musical influence on me would be Ani Kvafian, who's been at the festival several times, so my teacher at Yale. And, you know, Ani being a prominent chamber musician, she taught me to just examine the score with extreme diligence and try to draw as much as you can from what the composer has taught you. So she would tell me not to avoid changing bowings, you know, if you don't need to. Of course, you can always change, you know, if a composer has written a slur which connects, say, eight notes, you can always change it, but you should always aim to keep the bowings if you can, and so that you maintain the composer's original intention of how these notes should be grouped together. And she would also just have me examine every marking, whether the dynamics or expressive markings that the composer had written, and try to base my interpretation off of that. And I think that helped me a lot as a performer, but it's also helped me so much as a teacher, because one thing you find with young students is they'll play something in a certain way and you'll say, well, why did you play it that way? And they'll say, well, I don't know. I just sort of felt like doing it that way. And when you start working with other people, that becomes very problematic, because if you can't explain why you're doing something, you can't convince other people to do it your way. So she helped me a lot to become, I think, a more intellectual musician and to be more honest to the score.
Oh, well, that sounds like very important people in your life and your career for certain. Now, I have been told that you play a violin that is almost 350 years old. What do you know about its history, if anything? And besides its age, what makes the instrument so remarkable?
Sure. Well, I am currently playing on the Birkitch Pennington Carlo Bergonzi violin of 1737. Carlo Bergonzi is seen as one of the greatest violin makers of all time. His work is only overshadowed by Antonio Stradivari and another maker, Giuseppe Del Gesù. And those are Stradivari and Del Gesù are seen kind of tied as the two greatest artists, violin makers of all times. Carlo Bergonzi actually inherited Stradivari's workshop upon his death. And so he used much of the same wood. He actually apprenticed with Stradivari and Del Gesù. And so his work through the 30s and into the 40s kind of ended the great period of violin, the golden age of violin making in Cremona, Italy. Their secrets and the perfection of these instruments has never been matched. So I'm incredibly lucky to play on this violin. Actually, when I chose to play on the Bergonzi, I actually got to choose between a Stradivari and the Bergonzi, and I chose the Bergonzi. Everybody knows the name Stradivarius. Very few know the name Bergonzi, but that's starting to change, and it should, because they're just truly incredible instruments.
Yeah.
So this violin, I know some of its history throughout the 20th century. So it was played by John Pennington, who was the first violinist of the London String Quartet, which is a prominent string quartet in the mid-20th century. And then after that, it was owned by a name, I think John Raimondi, who was a concertmaster in New York Philharmonic. And then he retired with the instrument to Maine, and the instrument was kind of gone for a while. And in back in the early 2000s, it was recovered and sold, set a world record price when it was sold in 2008, I believe. And then I was lucky to get this opportunity to play on it. Interesting about Bergonzis, there's only 50 or so left in existence. So they're extremely rare, where, for instance, there's about 500 Stradivari violins in existence, of which half are in some sort of playing condition. So Bergonzis are extremely rare. It's a little more common to see a Strad and get to play on a Strad. It's almost impossible to get your hands out of Bergonzi. So I'm very lucky to play this instrument.
Wow, that is very cool. And even though I overshot and it's not actually even 300 years old, that's still a very impressive history. Now, the Geneva Music Festival has grown tremendously in geographical and musical scope over this decade. But what are some of your hopes and plans for the future? And what kinds of new artists or events do you think you might like to have going forward?
Well, I think the potential for this festival is somewhat unlimited, as long as we continue to have this kind of amazing community support. I don't want to get in trouble with our other board of directors, but I'll throw out a couple ideas I have. I would love to see more interaction with students in Geneva throughout the year. And we've kind of tended to do our outreach program, our community engagement concerts right before the festival in June. And that's a very busy time in the school district. And it's very busy as we're getting ready for our concerts. So I would love to see a little bit more interaction throughout the year as a whole. It's my hope that eventually we'll have enough audience members to have a repeat concert of all our concerts in Geneva. So we usually do one concert in Geneva and then one concert. We repeat each concert, you know, elsewhere. So we'll do one evening in Geneva and then one evening in Scaniatlis or Canandaigua or Auburn. So I'd like to see maybe two concerts in Geneva with that kind of audience support. I'd also like to see, as we grow our regional prominence, that people start to travel into Geneva to attend our concerts. We've been lucky to have a lot of support from the winery industry, from the restaurant industry, from educational institutions. And I think the more we can bring people into Geneva and support the economy and support those businesses, the more opportunity there will be for the music festival. But I mean, the artists that we bring are truly second to none. I hope that we can continue finding creative ways, to connect with our audiences, keep finding ways to be a leader in innovating the field of classical music, you know, keep asking difficult questions about, you know, what kind of music should we present? Should we only play music from Europe between, you know, 1750 and 1900? Or, you know, how can we keep expanding this canon of classical music?
Fair enough. And we look forward to welcoming you back on campus to the Guerin Center, hopefully the next time around as well. Well, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions since you dodged one of my earlier ones. Favorite violin concerto?
Oh, that's a good one. I would say the Brahms Violin Concerto is my all-time favorite. It's something I worked on for at least 7 years nonstop. And it's what I've always used whenever I take in an audition. It just has a near and dear place to my heart.
Well, it is a very beautiful piece. And final one, a little more obscure. Favorite piece for string orchestra?
String orchestra.
Get rid of all those winds and brass. Just
string. Yeah. No, you know, I'm a real romantic at heart, honestly. And I'm always drawn to music that has a romantic kind of inspiration and element. So I love Tchaikovsky's string serenade. Let's see.
The Dvorak one is also good.
Dvorak is nice as well. Strauss actually wrote a piece called Metamorphosen. I had the chance to play with an ensemble from Yale and Carnegie Hall a bunch of years back. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. But it's funny you asked that question. Especially with these times, I've been brainstorming about having a leading a student ensemble, string ensemble, and kind of a conductorless ensemble. And I've been looking at different string orchestra pieces that we could use, but those would definitely be two of my favorites.
Great, great, great answers. Well, it's been great talking to you, Jeffrey. I'm looking forward to seeing some of the concerts this summer, or actually spring, as we're starting pretty soon now, and again in the years to come as well. Thank you for being a guest today on the Pulteney Street Podcast.
Thanks for having me.